Governments around the world use prisons to try and control people, their actions, and beliefs. Under the military dictatorship in Burma, repression and the use of imprisonment takes on a particularly brutal form. In her novel, The Lizard Cage, author Karen Connolly takes us there, that is, to the depths of a small and harsh solitary confinement cell in a Burmese prison. She immerses us into a world of intense repression and brutality, but also of humanity, courage, and dignity in the face of these intense conditions. In that cell, she explores the edges of humanity, delving into the mindset of the jailed and the jailer. Karen Connolly is a poet and author who has spent several years in Burma, Thailand, and along the border between the two countries. Karen joins us on the phone from her home in Toronto to talk to us more about her novel, The Lizard Cage. Thanks for joining us tonight, Karen.
My pleasure.
The novel is based around Teza, who's a political prisoner who's been living in solitary confinement in Burma for 7 years. Can you tell us how he got there and what his world is like?
Well, Teza, the character, the main character, the protagonist in The Lizard Cage, is still a young man, but he was an even younger man when he was picked up by military intelligence agents after participating in protests protests that are based on the real events that took place in Burma in 1988, when there were massive countrywide protests, demonstrations, marches against the military dictatorship demanding a return to multi-party democracy. And like many real young men and women at that time, Teza was a university student who was involved in university and student politics and the political movements that were happening on various campuses across the country. And like some of them, like a real man on whom he's partly based, he took to singing some of the songs that he wrote in public, and they were protest songs against the military dictatorship. And it was because of the great popularity of those songs and how the few tapes that he made were, you know, copied by hundreds and thousands of people, he became a kind of public enemy of the state. And so he's picked up by military intelligence agents, taken to one of the many interrogation centers that were set up for those young and sometimes not so young protesters, where he was tortured for a long period of time, and then without any kind of due process, he is sent to a prison on the outskirts of Rangoon and is sentenced to 20 years in solitary confinement, which is also, again, a realistic sentence now, and certainly in 1988 and 1989, a sentence that was commonly meted out to those people who had taken part in these public protests.
So the whole book is basically takes place in the prison, in his solitary confinement cell. Can you paint us a little bit of a picture of what's happening for him, what's around him, what's his experiences like in that cell?
Again, it's all based, these are all details that are based on real conditions that former political prisoners told me about and talked with me about it at great length. So Teza is in an 8x10 cell. There's really nothing in it except a few of his personal belongings and a sleeping mat and a blanket and a latrine pail where he can go to the bathroom. And just outside the cell, there's a water pot that he can get water from. And basically, his life revolves around the visits that he receives from the person who brings him his food, who is actually a criminal prisoner, and also from a jailer. There are a couple different jailers who come to see him. One of the jailers who sees him on a regular basis is somebody named Chit Nang, and he's quite a sympathetic character and has a very complicated relationship with his own work as a jailer. He feels beholden that he must do it, but he also feels very guilty. And he becomes very good friends with Teza, and they have quite a profound relationship. And he also is sometimes visited by another jailer who is a very angry person who believes wholeheartedly in the work that the regime is doing to, you know, stamp out these communists and these crazy protesters who are trying to destabilize the country, etc. And so he's angry. He's a much more volatile person. He can be quite violent. And within the context of the story, within the shape of how the book changes, eventually the server that comes to bring Teza his food also changes, and the server becomes a young boy who works in the prison. And that also becomes a very important friendship for Teza. There's a whole complex plot as well in the novel about an effort among the political prisoners to send messages out of the prison. And Teza gets kind of pulled into this effort, which we're not sure if it's fictitious, if it's an effort to try and entrap him, in fact, if there really are political prisoners writing messages outside of the prison or not. And eventually the pen that he uses to write a letter to the leader of the opposition, Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, the pen becomes the kind of linchpin that the whole apparatus, the whole plot apparatus turns on. This pen becomes a kind of talisman of power and of danger, and what happens to the pen and where the pen goes becomes a kind of mystery in the book, really. A rather hair-raising mystery, if I do say so myself. So he lives in this small space, and he reaches out into the prison through these various people, and we also get some experience of what his life was like before and why he became involved in politics and who his parents were, who his family is. He has a brother who refused to stay in Burma, like many young men and women. He left Burma to go fight the good fight on the Thai-Burma border. He joined armed revolutionaries to try and change his country from the outside in. And Teza insisted on staying, and his fate was that, you know, he's arrested and he's sentenced to this awful experience in prison.
There's lots of people in the book struggling with different things. One of the things I really enjoyed about got into about your book was the different mindsets of the jailer and jailed. And you mentioned two of the characters who are jailers who are both struggling a little bit. One, as you mentioned, moves more towards becoming a sympathizer, and the other actually starts inflicting more increasing levels of brutality and violence. And you mentioned them a little bit. I just was wondering if you can tell us a bit more about them, their journeys, and some of that mindset of the jailer that you really get into and explore in your book.
Yeah, the one is called, as I said, his name is Chitnain, and he's the more sympathetic character who develops this very profound, very life-changing relationship with Teza. And the other one, his nickname is Handsome. And he's called Handsome because he is quite handsome. He's quite a beautiful man. But the strange thing about his beauty is that it covers this soul, this self that is, as you say, increasingly ugly in the book and increasingly cruel to, particularly to Teza, the prisoner that he's in charge of. For a time, and then he's actually taken off of Teza's beat, of Teza's cell. He doesn't work with him after a while, but he develops this almost a kind of obsession about him basically how Teza makes this harsh jailer feel. And I wanted to look at those two characters and set them up almost as foils, you know, the good cop, bad cop, because they are real, and they do actually, that kind of character, that kind of those kind of relationships in the prisons, in Burma and in most prisons, I'm sure, throughout the world, they do exist. There are jailers, there are warders and wardens who are much more sympathetic and who develop almost sometimes quite close friendships with the men that they live and work beside. And then there are those jailers, wardens, warders who, in an effort to, you know, protect themselves almost from their experiences, they choose, or they almost unconsciously become quite the opposite. And I wanted to explore the humanity and just the human foibles of both of those kind of people. And I was, throughout the novel and throughout a lot of my work, I'm really interested in what happens to people who are traumatized, to people who have been in their own lives, particularly their childhoods, who have been violated, and how that violation plays out in adult life and what happens to those people. And something that is very common in the prison world, again, the political prison world and the criminal prison world, is that those people who've experienced trauma and have never resolved it or healed it in any way often end up in the prison system, not only as criminal prisoners, but as jailers and warders, people who are attracted to the power dynamics of prisons, of someone being basically under their, you know, under their power, in their power, within the realm of their own personal power, and those who have gone against a whole system of power and have, you know, turned their wounding outward into the world and attacked the world because of what they have experienced. So I was very curious about the interplay of all of that stuff, and I tried to explore that as much as I could in The Lizard Cage with all of those characters and how they behave with each other. And, you know, there's that character of the boy as well. He is a kind of he's a kind of experiment in himself. It's, the question about him is, what will happen to that boy, the child laborer who lives and works in the prison, who knows nothing about the and is in fact afraid of the free world, as much as there can be a free world in Burma, in a country like Burma. You know, will he choose to become violent, to become cruel, to close himself off because of the quite disturbing circumstances of his own life, or will he be able to escape that? Will he be able to transform what has happened to him? So I, you know, those questions of transformation and why people become the way they become are themes for me, and they play out. I mean, I say I wanted to have them play out in this novel, but it was quite, in fact, an organic process.
Yeah, I found that interesting about the character of the boy, and then what you were able to do with him, because he was living in a prison but wasn't sentenced to be there. So the way that the prison impacted his psyche and his self and some of his struggles with his own freedom and living in the cage but not having to live in the cage, but that's the only world he really knew, I think really you were really able to explore some of those complexities where he kind of fell outside of the jailer or jailed kind of dichotomy that mm-hmm. the other characters were fell into.
Yeah, it was unclear what he was, and just the whole notion of power and what is power, particularly when someone is in prison. How, like Teza, the main character, but also the men in this case, it's a men's prison, so there are no women, but also the men who are working there and living there, be they political or criminal. And then, of course, in this novel, the little boy, how will he become? What will he become because of his experiences? And what is it to have some kind of power over the self when you're in a constrained situation and a truly constrained situation. I mean, a situation in which escape in some ways is not really a possibility when you just have to sit there. Who do you become in that? And of course, that question leads to, or is part of another big theme of the book, which is Buddhism and literally sitting, Buddhist meditation, because that's one of the ways that Teza survives his experiences.
Yeah, that was something else I wanted to touch on, because that's the other sort of edge of the book, was the way in which Teza faced that brutality and really worked to maintain his integrity and humanity in face of that intense repression. And one of those ways was through his Buddhist practice. Just curious if you can tell us a little bit more about that, about his struggle, and why you chose to make that central to the book.
Well, I chose to make it central to the book because it's a central theme in the lives of many, many, not all, but many, many of the former political prisoners that I spent time with, both in Burma and on the Thai-Burma border. The great majority of them spoke about how, even if they weren't particularly devout or even interested Buddhists when they went into prison, the experience of being in prison made them call up all of their Buddhist training, their Buddhist knowledge, in order to help them to survive. So all of that, you know, the mindfulness meditation technique, so just simply sitting and being in the moment and focusing on the breath, and the techniques of allowing emotion to kind of roll over you and pass, so that they could survive these incredible bouts of rage and despair that they would go through, and also just trying to keep in mind all of the major Buddhist tenets, you know, to be compassionate, to respect life, to not lie. You know, those things became very, very important to people, both the men and women, former prisoners that I spent time with. And it's not the only religion in Burma, but Buddhism is certainly the major one. And it was a real tool for people to survive sometimes incredibly horrific experiences, you know, weeks of torture sometimes, and long prison sentences, often in very dirty, very, very small cells, sometimes smaller than the cell that Teza is in the novel, and, you know, long, long periods for having done nothing, you know, written poems or been carrying the wrong kind of book or publishing something in a magazine or nothing at all. I mean, so many people spent time in prisons and are still spending time in prisons for having really done absolutely nothing. So, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, because we have so much freedom, most of us, in North America, it's hard for us to imagine what it would be like to be, you know, to have the classic scenario, which is they come to your house in the middle of the night, they bang on your door, they force the door open, there's a search through the house for something that, you know, they can or cannot find, and you are taken out and you're pushed down on the floor of the car and you're taken to an interrogation center, and all these, you know, horrific things happen to your body. How do you survive those things? And meditation is a perfect tool, an actual tool with a kind of plan around it that you can use to remove yourself from some of those experiences, or to mitigate those experiences, to lessen them somehow. Those are those really brutal, dehumanizing experiences. And certainly Teza, throughout the novel, uses Buddhist techniques to calm his emotions, to lessen his own rage toward his captors and towards the violence that he feels for them sometimes. So it was just a natural part of the growing of the book that I would explore how Buddhism actually worked for this person who was in prison.
I found that the way that Teza was able to maintain his humanity in face of that repression and the violence that he experienced, it was inspiring because, you know, you sort of think if he can maintain his humanity in such conditions, then it's sort of inspiring in terms of the ways that we can resist oppression and the way that it manifests in our lives, and that there's sort of always hope and a way to maintain your humanity no matter what you face, which I think is one of the themes that comes out in your book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know. It's so hard, isn't it? It's so hard to maintain our humanity, and we have it so easy most of the time. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, not to have road rage can be really difficult.
Yeah.
Imagine if somebody had beaten you almost to death and broken your jaw. Imagine how pissed off you'd be then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was something. I mean, that exactly what you said. It's something that was a real education for me as I wrote the novel and thought about some of the really deep meanings of Buddhism and the whole all of those ideas that the words that we say quite easily, you know, compassion and patience and empathy and all of that stuff. What do those things really mean, even for us in our day-to-day lives?
You spent some time in Burma and on the Thai Burmese border, where a lot of political exiles are living. Is that where the novel came out of, or how did you come to write this book?
I first went to Burma with real concerns about political prisoners. I was interested in their physical conditions and in their coping mechanisms. I had done a lot of work in Canada for PEN, which is an organization somewhat like Amnesty International that lobbies on behalf of political prisoners. And so I was interested in particular in a young woman's case. Her name is Matira, and I was curious about her because she was very close to my own age at the time. I think she was 26, 27 or 28, and I was 26 when I learned about her. She had actually been Aung San Suu Kyi's campaign manager for a time, but she was arrested for having written short stories that seemed to be critical of the regime. And like the character Teza, she was sentenced to 20 years in solitary confinement for having written those short stories. And in fact, she did not serve those 20 years, thankfully, because of organizations like PEN and like Amnesty International. There was a great lobbying on her behalf, and she was actually released after 7 years of solitary confinement. But she contracted tuberculosis while she was in prison. She had some terrible gynecological problems that I believe left her infertile. You know, so she certainly suffered a lot, even though she didn't serve out the 20-year sentence. So I was very interested in her case, and I was also interested just in how regular people and painters and artists survive under a dictatorship. So I thought that I would write a nonfiction book about Burmese people living under dictatorship and how they lived, how they survived, how they continued to have a daily domestic life despite, you know, the censorship, the incredible surveillance that Burmese people live with all the time. There's an huge network of informers in the country. You know, there are just constant human rights abuses and a very, very foreshortened, a very shrunken way of living because people are always scared of what might happen to them if they do this or if they do that or if their brother or their mother or their father does this. You know, what can happen to us? They live with a sense of of much being able to happen to them, bad things being able to happen to them very easily. So I was really fascinated by, despite all of that, by how courageous people are and how funny they are and how incredibly well-read they are in this place that is so, you know, so starved for books and a free literary culture. It's an incredibly literate culture despite this terrible censorship that, you know, that has stifled people so terribly for almost 40 years. So I was very inspired by that. Again, inspired by this incredible sense of humor that people had and also by the graciousness that I met in Burmese people on a regular basis. You know, I was very, very well taken care of, very welcomed there. And so I wanted to write about those people. Unfortunately, after a couple of visits, I couldn't get a visa to go back in. I was blacklisted after photographing more protests that took place in December 1996. So that led me to spend time on the Thai-Burma border, where there is this active population of exiles and dissidents and revolutionaries who are working against the Burmese regime. And I was just fascinated to meet this culture of revolution, to have this new education, a different kind of education than the one that I had received in Burma, this education in dissident politics and how these people had basically given over their lives to this struggle to bring democratic change and to prepare for democratic change in Burma. And the thing that bound so many of those people together, the one experience that was so common and similar for many of them, was the experience of prison. Many of them had been in prison. Many of them had relatives who were in prison or who were still in prison. Many of them had lost people in prison. You know, people had gone missing in the prison system. They had all read and been inspired by, been motivated by prison journals and prison books that had been smuggled through Burma or had, you know, been somehow printed and bound and you know, functioned as tracts of resistance. And so I had already, again, I'd known about the situation in Burmese prisons and the number of political prisoners and things. But when I was on the border, I understood viscerally and repeatedly how central to Burmese life is the experience of prison. And so therefore it was confirmed for me that to continue talking to people about their prison experiences and also to start writing about those prison experiences was a thread that I needed to follow. And because I couldn't get back into Burma, I felt like I couldn't really write that nonfiction book anymore. And because I wanted to tell a whole story, a big story, it was a fairly natural step to decide that, in fact, I had to commit myself to a novel.
And it took you almost 10 years to finish?
It was a bloody big commitment. It did. It took me a good 9 years. It took me almost a decade to write the book, which was in its own way. I mean, I certainly don't mean to compare myself to anyone who has lived in solitary confinement for a decade, but in its way, it was a kind of sentence for me. It was a very, very, very difficult thing to do. It was very painful. And a kind of, I don't know, it was a kind of, well, it was certainly an engagement with the whole idea of prison, not just prisons in Burma and political prisons, but prisons everywhere, certainly prisons in Canada, and just the human prison, how people build prisons, how we make them, how we have a mythology around them, how we also disappear all people who go to prisons. On some level, they become invisible to the wider society. And so I was pulled into that whole world, the world, the idea, the theory of prison and what prison is, and again how we exercise our power upon people who we have imprisoned and what happens to those people. I spent more than a decade finally thinking about those things, because of course when the book came out, then I spent a good lot of time talking about this very subject.
And here you are again, still talking about it.
It's a good thing to talk about. It's an important thing to talk about.
Yeah, because you really some of the scenes that you wrote in there, I mean, I was just amazed in the way that you were able to write really brutal and violent scenes in a way that didn't glorify or simplify or like sort of hold back from the impact, but it was done in a way that was, I don't know, it must have been a really challenging thing to write about.
Well, I'm glad it was challenging, and I'm glad you read it with that kind of open eye. And I think a few people have mentioned that to me, like that kind of, we're used to, particularly obviously on television and in movies, we're used to seeing violence shown in a way that, well, A, we don't really even notice it anymore because we do see it an awful lot. We kind of roll our eyes or look away from the screen or just observe it without actually engaging in it emotionally. Or we're disgusted by the violence, and so we don't look at it. We flip the channel, or we refuse to go to the violent movies, which I'm sure is a good idea. Or whatever. We have our ways of dealing with the actual violence that we see in the media. Obviously, there's a whole other level to violence, and that is the real violence that takes place between people that we witness or participate in or you know, remember having participated in. And so that's something else apart. But in terms of media, we don't often have an experience where we are... It's like sex, actually, in media. We don't often have an experience, either reading or watching TV or movies, or, of course, seeing the news, where that violence or that sexuality is portrayed to us in such a way that we become committed. We, too, are there. We, too, can appreciate what is happening, either on the part of the perpetrator, if it's violence, or the lovemaker, or whatever. It's very rare for that to happen. It's even rare in literature for violence to be shown for what it is, which is a form of intimacy. It is a form of the bodies being very close and being alive, even if what happens is a diminishment of life or even death. We're not used to seeing that. Again, if you live a violent life, then you feel it, and you can feel the adrenaline of that, and you can feel how it can make you feel more alive. It brings you to sort of the raw edge of being human. The way sex does, it's strange that, I mean, Tezai in the novel talks about that. He had the same feelings after he was beaten in a way that he would have after having made love, but the two things were so opposite, and it was confusing to him that he would feel somehow the same, somehow that these two experiences were connected. But again, they're connected by virtue of the body, by the body being awake and being alive and being raw, being itself. And I think that was an understanding that I came to thinking a lot about violence. And I mean, you know, in other incarnations in my own life, thinking about sex too, and what it is, what are those two things that are so profound and so powerful? And there's a terrible lack of that in the media. That really, I mean, art when it's really good, it is about how we're human, and it can teach us why and how we're human. And so I think that I struggled with that a lot. Like, I can speak about it now, but certainly when I was working on the novel, I couldn't speak about it. I didn't understand what I was trying to do. It took a long time. There you go. That's why it took so long.
Yeah, well, I like the way that you worded that, being present in that moment. It's very powerful, I think. And it is true that, you know, now that you've put it that way, it's an interesting way to look at it. I'm also curious about what you faced writing this book, because being a white Westerner and writing writing about Burma and writing about being in a Burmese prison. What came up for you about that, and how did you deal with those challenges?
Well, I think that that's another reason why it took me a long time, because I was constantly, maybe not exactly second-guessing myself. I felt very dedicated to what I had chosen to do, and I had the blessing of the people that I had interviewed and become friends with and talked to at length about their experiences, the Burmese people. But I certainly felt uncomfortable about telling the story of a people to whom I do not belong. I am not Burmese. I have no Burmese history. I have no Burmese connection, other than the fact that I went to Burma and I spent time on the Thai-Burma border and, you know, became very impassioned about what was happening there and developed some close relationships with Burmese people. But I was always a bit worried and anxious that, you know, did I have the right to do this? Was this appropriate? Was I doing it correctly? Was I, again, all those questions, was I sentimentalizing things? Was I glorifying the violence or cheapening the experience somehow by bringing it into the open? You know, was I stealing the story from someone? Who would write this if I didn't write it? I mean, those were real concerns for me. And they were partly real concerns because in Canada, in the late 80s and early 90s, the whole voice appropriation debate was raging at the time when I was kind of coming of age as a writer, and I had already chosen to write quite a bit about other cultures and how those cultures affect me. And in the novel, I wasn't writing at all about myself. I mean, not obviously in any overt way, but though the voice appropriation debate had certainly settled quite a bit by the time I was working on the book, you know, from 96, 97 to 2005 when I finished it, that the ghost of the voice appropriation debate was still very, very lively in my mind. And it's, you know, it was a debate that happened for a good reason. So the questions that I was asking myself and the worries that I had about what I was doing, those were good worries to have. You know, I the book wouldn't have been as good if I didn't have them. You know, it made me be very careful about what I was doing, and it made me check my details and, you know, get permission from the people that I was talking to all the time. It made me very careful.
And so what are you working on these days? Are you working on another book about Burma, or?
Oh, I am. Enough already, but I can't help it. I wanted to write about, I did, in fact, after I finished the novel, I decided that I did want to write about my own experiences there and how that political and personal education changed me, affected me. So that book is called Burmese Lessons, and it is the story of the time that I spent in Burma and why spending time in Burma impelled me to become further involved and more curious about the political struggle, the dissenting political struggle against the dictatorship. And it's also about a relationship that I had with a Burmese revolutionary on the Thai-Burma border, and how that relationship really brought me to a kind of crux in my life, a place where I had to decide to go in one direction or another. And of course, I won't tell you what happens in the end. So it's a much more, it's a very different book. It's a much more personal book, nonfiction.
When's that due out?
That is due out in, let's see, fall 2009.
Well, next year then.
There we go.
Well, I could ask you many more questions, but we're running a little bit out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us and speaking with us and sharing a little bit about your novel and the whole process of writing that novel.
Thank you. It was a very good interview. It was my pleasure again. Thank you so much.
We have been speaking with Karen Connolly, and she's the author of The Lizard Cage. For more information about her and the book, you can go to her website. It's www.karenconnolly.ca.